Welcome to Catspina Music. In this episode, I talk with my cousin, Tom Spina, who isn't your ordinary sculptor and artist. We explore his journey into movie prop restoration, guitar building, team leading, and a milestone that opened his eyes to the fact people do creative things for a living.
The first thing that came into my mind was the attic and seeing all of these props and Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy. And I just thought in my mind, what in the world is he doing? This is so cool. And I was just wondering, you know, maybe we could just start off here. What did you discover in those early years and being drawn to such a unique way to explore art that sort of set the tone for having this be something you want to pursue in life?
Well, first off, thank you for the nice intro and trip down memory lane. It's hard to put a finger on any sort of real impetus. I can kind of think of a few markers along the way, but I think this is probably the way it is for a lot of creatives. You know, it's something that just always was. It wasn't like I had to go find this. It wasn't like I've ever wondered why I was here or what I needed to do in this world. Like, I literally, from as early as I can remember, just wanted to make stuff. And usually it was stuff I saw in TV and movies and stuff like that, or maybe it was music. And it's just, yeah, it's weird. It's just always been there. I think it's interesting to me. I kind of wonder every once in a while. I just ask my mother, I'm like, what did you think?
Right. Like, you know, exactly.
Where did you think this led? And I just remember her talking about when I started Tom Spina Designs and was going full time with it. I was leaving a really nice, high paying job with lots of benefits that was very steady, and I could have stayed with and you know, just done a career there and retired on that. And I was leaving that to start this company and to do all of this crazy stuff for a living. She, at the time, you know, was supportive, but a little detached from it, you know. But she recently intimated to me, she was like, I thought you were crap. I was like, is he nuts? What is he doing? You know, like, but she came around. My dad was also, he was on board a little more. He was always more entrepreneurial anyway. I like to think I get a bit of my business sense from him. He was what brought him around. And it's funny, I'm telling you the story of my creativity about basically in the milestones of how other people just came around to what I knew when I was two. But dad really came around after I did my internship with the Muppets. So I did an internship there. And I was on Sesame Street for a season as an assistant puppet wrangler. And that opened both my eyes and his to the idea that people do creative things for a living. That brought him around. And it was this idea that, you know, oh, wow, he's going to a sound studio and, you know, going to work at this thing. This is now 6 months of this, and he's surrounded by 100 people that do a creative job, and that's their job. So I think that helped to open his eyes to the idea that this is practical and not just fantasy.
Wow, that's so powerful because, you know, again, being cousins, I think what we have seen and the constructs of the lineage of the careers, they were solid 9-to-5, civil service jobs, grandpa being a mailman, to toll booth collector, to my dad being a professor. It's so interesting to want to be perceived a certain way by the ones that we love in order to know that this is feasible and this is doable. So it sounds like just hearing this story, you were always drawn to it, but then there was just that piece of wanting to feel supported that it did make sense to walk right. away from security yeah. and feel like I'm not just totally throwing it all away. You mentioned the Muppets, and I know Jim Henson, I'm sure, would be one of your idols. Were there any mentors or people that you shadowed along the way to sort of learn just this very intricate and fragile art of restoration? Is there somebody that sticks out in your mind?
So it's interesting. The restoration work grew out of work I was doing making masks and monsters myself. And basically what you start to learn when you're making stuff is that when you pour rubber into a mold, or you're trying to make a copy of something or whatever, there's always little things that go wrong. And you learn to fix those things along the way. And it turned out I got really good at fixing things. Maybe that meant I was really bad at casting things. I don't know. But ultimately, I started to figure out that, like, you know, if you can rebuild texture, and if you can, and you can fill in the missing spots on something that is a brand new casting, well, maybe that could be applied to a really old piece, like a prop or a thing like that. And this is late 90s, where you start to have people collecting original movie props on a more widespread scale. The internet had been out for a while. The auction houses now had reach that they didn't have before. And you now have people who didn't know that, oh, wow, I could get a costume that was worn by my favorite actor in one of my favorite movies. That really grabbed a lot of people. There's a lot of folks that are really passionate about saving this material and about collecting it and sharing it with each other and things like that. And so, you know, now you start to realize, oh, well, a lot of this stuff is made out of foam latex, which is a material that doesn't last forever always. And that does need special care and special support. And I knew about the materials, and it turned out I had a talent for recreating textures and missing bits, and I could take on the sort of artistic approach of the people who made it. You know, it's you when you sculpt your own piece, you can put your stamp on it. When you sculpt someone else's piece, or when you restore someone else's piece, you have to be fluid and become, you know, you have to mimic their hand. You can't fix a 1960s mask with a circa 2020, hyper-realistic silicone approach. You've got to give it a little bit of boogity-ness and that 60s vibe. And that's the thing that a friend of mine coined the term sympathetic restoration. And sure. I love that term. And I feel like that's the thing that's always in my mind when I'm restoring something. That's the message I try to get across to my whole crew. You know, you have to become the original person that made this. You have to restore it in a way that the piece tells you. You know, the piece will let you know how much you can do and how much you can't. And our job is to make everything we've done as invisible as possible. If someone just looks at the prop a few years later and goes, oh, wow, that's 40 years old. That looks really good for 40 years old. That's the exact thing we want to hear. If someone looked at it and went, oh, that looks brand new, then we failed. You know, we want it to look new. We want it to be authentic. We want it to be original. And now I had heroes that had done the work originally, guys like Rick Baker, guys like Stuart Freeborn, Phil Tippett, Greg Canham, all of these different, Tom Savini, of course, makeup artists and people who, some of whom, like Savini, had a great book that taught a lot of techniques to making the stuff in the first place. But there really wasn't anyone out there in terms of the restoration stuff. A lot of that I kind of had to make up. And what I did was read up on museum restoration, how they restore old textiles, how they restore paper goods, and try to incorporate those archival materials with the FX artist's touch to bring that over to the creature prop side, and to be able to save things like original Gremlins props and puppets and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and apes from 2001 and masks from Star Wars and all of these things that I loved growing up that now have come through our hands and are now, you know, still around for folks to enjoy because we put a little bit of a care into them. It's absolutely incredible to me that we even get the opportunity to be around this stuff, let alone to help keep it around for others to enjoy. It's unreal.
And hearing all of this, gaining the insight of it really being a learn by doing. You have to have that trial and error and kind of pioneering this hybrid of approach of the restoration meets the FX is fascinating. There's such a fine line between, just like you mentioned, you know, what was the actual original piece versus creating it again. Similar to the idea of a cover song. How are you reinterpreting something with trying to keep that integrity?
It's almost like the difference between remastering a song and covering it. And it would be like if you were remastering a song, but there was a little strip of, maybe a 5-second bit of the guitar was missing in the track for some reason on the original masters. So you had to go in and come up with that little bit of missing guitar, but do it in such a way where the guitar tone, the playing, the action, the vibe all blend seamlessly in what's around it.
Right.
And that really is, that's like the musical equivalent of what we're doing for sure.
Exactly. And of course, I remember how building guitars is also one of your other favorite pastimes. And did the building the guitars, that also happen around the same time as you're coming into your art of the restoration? When did you get into the building?
So that came about much earlier. So for me,
interesting.
Making things ever since I was a kid, whether that was cardboard, foam, clay, whatever I could get my hands on. Whatever wasn't nailed down in Dad's workshop, you know,
right.
Just be like, where's my stapler? You know? and then ultimately, I would say late 80s, my aunt and yours gave me an old guitar, no name 60s guitar that had only two strings on it. And I taught myself how to play on those two strings. And eventually went to a little music shop and got myself a Cort guitar, C-O-R-T, I believe, that had two single coil pickups and six strings. So that was a nice change. And learned how to tune a guitar and then learned how to play a little bit on my own, mostly playing along to Motley Crue, Shout at the Devil. the album, not just the song. And then... then eventually, you know, got another guitar from that same shop, traded in the first one. And that one was like decent. It was like a two humbucker Strat style guitar with a whammy bar like that. You know, I could mess with that. I could play that. And that was the guitar I started to tinker on. And that's when I started to learn that you could switch out the pickups and that might sound a little different, or you could put a better tremolo system and it won't go out of tune. And I bought a book from, you know, just local bookstore that was how to do basic wiring for a guitar and some basic fretwork and things like that. And that, just working out of that book, was how I started building. And so, you know, this is late 80s at this point. I would go to the, maybe even early 90s now, I'm going to all of the local guitar shops and seeing what they had in the bin, you know, like, oh, you got a couple of old necks. I'll take those. You know, you got any old pickups and like whatever I could get cheap.
Sure.
And just looking for gems, you know, looking for diamonds in the rough. And every once in a while, I'd find a really good pickup that was either, you know, an old DiMarzio Super Distortion or even one of the DiMarzio PAFs with the double cream look to it. Or I found someone had a guitar that came from an old burned building, but it had a single coil pickup in it with square pole pieces that I couldn't ID the pickup for anything, but it sounded beautiful. It was sparkly. So I would just mess with it and I would try and get different sounds. I would try different string combinations. So, you know, what does a 12 string sound like? Try messing, you know, make one of those. I would see stuff in videos and, you know, Steve Vai had his 7-string at some point. And I said, well, I can make a 7-string. Let me just add, you know, like messing with the bridge and just add a little bit. And and just see what that's like to play on. It was just another outlet. You know, and like you said, we Spinas don't sit still well.
No, so, not at all.
No. So it would be, you know, I'd be building that stuff. And then all the while I'm making puppets, I'm making props, I'm making costumes, action figures, like whatever. I just have the need to make stuff. I don't know. Adam Savage talks about that kind of thing a lot. He's, you know, his whole thing is the maker movement. And I definitely get it. Like, I am right there. It's just the idea that, you know, as cool as it is to get something off the shelf, it's kind of cool when you can tailor something to yourself.
Right.
And I did not mean for that to rhyme, but it did, so I'm sticking with it.
There you go. This ever-evolving exploration in any sense of it, which is inspiring. What do you think in the most recent years has been your biggest turning point professionally?
Taking, a real, real, you know, kind of dividing mark that I can find is going from a home studio to a studio space for the business. You know, the first few years of the business, I worked out of one room in the house, and then it was two rooms in the house, then it was two rooms and half the garage, then it was two rooms in the whole garage. Then my wife said, it's winter, I need the garage. And I start looking for studio space. But it was, you know, doing that allowed me, and this was really important to me, actually. So as soon as I got the studio space, I never wanted to do it where it was just my house because I felt it was weird. But I reached out to all the local colleges and I asked about their internship programs. And I remembered back to, you know, my internship with the Muppets and how that literally changed my life. And I said, maybe here's an opportunity for me to show new kids that people can do a creative thing for a living and give some of them a chance and maybe even find some good people for the crew in the process. And so that was one of the first things I did. And we found a studio space that was a very short drive from my house. We're actually still in that studio, although we've taken over the two units directly behind us. In fact, one of them we took over in 2014. The other one we took over right at the end of last year. And that one was a nice big unit, so it doubled our space, which is outstanding. But yeah, you know, half of the crew we have now were interns. They were people that we found at the local colleges who came to help us out for a semester and did it for credit. And we would, you know, challenge them along the way and try and get them to learn. And then, you know, when it came time for them to leave, we said, you know, what if you don't leave? What if you stick around and help us out for a bit more? And, you know, I've got people who've now been with me since 2012 that were, just kid interns who are now full-grown adults and married and kids. And it's crazy to see. And it's awesome.
People who aren't in this for a living and they're just seeing the final product always, no matter what I think we're pursuing in the creative arts, there is a team element. There's, you know, people that you entrust on your journey to make you the best you possible. And then the ways to communicate now everything that you've pioneered. And this is such a unique approach that you're taking to find people that you surround yourself with who you can trust and continue that legacy. I can only see this getting bigger, what you learned and how important it is to follow this. And then communicate new ways, how to use the technology, how to open up social media, which again is something I've seen you grow and really build. So I think there's just such a great thing to have in that teamwork aspect of it.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I'm super, super lucky. I have a great team of people that I work with that we've built up over, you know, all these years. And they each have internalized the sort of foundational mindset of our type of restoration. And that's, once they've done that, then they, you know, do the work and it's over time, they each kind of bring their own thing to it, though. And I'm not training everyone, they are. And now, you know, they're suggesting things to me that maybe I wouldn't have thought of. It all grows. It takes on a life of its own. And that's, you know, one of the coolest things out of all of this.
I always felt in our family, there was somebody doing something creative. It was important to me to check in and know what's going on with you, because it felt like to me that there was a way to have this in my life too.
Oh gosh, I had this weird, crazy life where I've been very lucky to have had dream project after dream project after dream project. It feels like stuff kind of comes out of nowhere when it gets to us. You know, we get that crew person from a movie who his wife finds a box that has been sitting in the garage for 40 years, and there's, you know, whatever this piece from a movie is. So you just don't know what's coming. I could say that of the stuff we've done, dream projects have been working with the Henson Archives and the Museum of the Moving Image to restore a bunch of stuff from Dark Crystal and Labyrinth. Stunning stuff to work on. And a lot of that, there's a touring exhibit that has some of it, and then a bunch that's on permanent display at Museum of the Moving Image in Queens, which is just amazing. Working for the Lucasfilm Archives, which, you know, as a kid, my dream was always to go to the prop warehouse where all the Star Wars stuff was kept, you know, and the Indiana Jones props. And to, as an adult, be invited over there in the first place was amazing. And then to go there now, sometimes with my company Regal Robot, where we're doing the licensed replica stuff of Star Wars, where we're going in to examine or 3D scan some of these original props. And then other times to go in, you know, by their request to come and restore stuff or to examine things that they're going to send to us to restore. Like, that's pinnacle of dream projects for me, for sure. And to be really face to face with not just props, but these characters that you grew up with on film, is something that's hard to even put into words. You know, that they're even there is just amazing, and that you're entrusted to, you know, be a caretaker for them for a little bit is just amazing and kind of a little bit mind blowing.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating.
I'm lucky that I don't get bored easily. I think maybe it's just down to us not sitting still again.
Right.
There's always something to inspire me. And I can, and that's something I think I get from my dad, actually, is he is one of the best audiences around.
Right.
And I can watch any movie, any television show, any, you know, even animated stuff. And I'm fascinated by the 3D computer stuff. I'm fascinated by any practical effect or creature or character that someone's made with their hands. I love sets and props and background. And basically, you know, television and film are one big magic trick. The thing you think you see isn't really what you're seeing, you know? And I can sit there and watch a movie to just enjoy the story, or I can go through it as art, go through it as magic, and figure out in my head, you know, wow, people put a lot of effort into this and what that must have been like. That's how I can find inspiration from that every day. And then, you know, on a more personal level, I can look around the studio and see all of the props that we happen to be working on at any given time, every project, and of course, all of the people that are there every day with me, and just draw inspiration from that as well.
I love that. Yeah, and that being sort of the process, you know, the process of creativity, and just knowing it from the two different sides of it. So that's incredible. Thank you so much today for being part of this podcast and this conversation about creativity. It really means a lot to me that you took the time out to dive in this with me together today. So thank you for that.
I thank you for having me. I'm honored to even be asked.
I'm inspired by inspired people. If you want to learn more about the process, creativity, and the journey, check out my website, catspinamusic.com. Thank you again for listening. So you hold on, hold on.